So we can now continue on with this sutta, the two kinds of thought. And where are we? Okay, so we have, this is part of the idea of right effort on the Buddhist path, how to deal with the thinking mind, how to deal with defilements and all of these kind of things. And we have just been looking at how to use wisdom to overcome sensual thoughts, thoughts of ill will, and also thoughts of harming. And we saw the nice little simile there about how to guard the cow as you guard your mind, a little bit like you guard a cow, according to this simile. And then we have this next paragraph, and this is kind of summarizes it a little bit, if you like. And it goes as follows. Bhikkhus, whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of sensual desire, he has abandoned thoughts of renunciation to cultivate the thought of sensual desire. And then his mind inclines to thoughts of sensual desire. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of ill will, thoughts of harming, he has abandoned the thought of non-harming to cultivate the thought of harming, and then his mind inclines to thought of harming. So the idea here is to change the habits of the mind, right? The mind has certain habits. These habits are often very strong. Things that come from the past somewhere, not really sure where they come from, but way in the past. And very powerful habits that are often very difficult to change. And this is one of the kind of things about this path, is that one of the things that we need to do is to try to overcome those old habits that are so ingrained in us. And this is one of the things that I often think about when I consider maybe other people, and I think that, oh, they're not really, you know, kind of, you want to change others and this kind of thing, which is very common, I think, among humans. You want to change other people, and not kind of, especially perhaps in family life, or people you are close together with. But the reality is that it's difficult enough to change our own habits, right? It's very hard to steer the mind in a new direction. And for that reason, we shouldn't really expect other people to change their habits either. It is often asking too much of people. It actually is a very difficult thing to do. And this is what this practice really is about, learning to change our habits gradually, stage by stage, by frequently thinking and pondering upon those positive thoughts, those thoughts that are heading in the right direction, and then at the same time undermining the thoughts that are going in the wrong way. This is what this really is about. So you learn, the more you kind of cultivate that thought of renouncing the sensual pleasures, the more you cultivate that, or maybe better example is to, the more you cultivate the metta, seeing the good points in other people, the more you actually abandon the thought of ill will, or if you like, the thought imbued with ill will. It's perhaps a better translation. A little bit strange, the thought of the ill will. It's more like a thought that has that as a basis, a motivating factor, a thought imbued with ill will. Probably better way of putting it, I think, in this particular case. So this is what is so nice about this in one way. It's also so difficult. You have to keep on cultivating and cultivating. The habits are so strong. You're like this freight train or this this big ship on the ocean. You've got a lot of momentum already, and it takes a long time to stop that freight train when it's hurtling along at maximum speed. And the same way with the thinking mind, all that momentum from the past, and often it is very, very deeply ingrained in us. It's the sort of thing we have maybe been doing for who knows how long, maybe for eons we've been kind of having these habits, and now finally we are doing something about it. And it is very, very extremely rewarding, because once you start to change your habits, once you start to go in a different direction, that becomes your new habit. Yeah, and you can actually feel how it becomes hard to have ill will, or becomes harder anyway. It becomes harder to desire all kind of silly things in life, because your mind actually is heading in a new direction. And that momentum, that habit becomes something else. And because that becomes the new habit, it's actually becoming much easier to be kind, to be caring, compassionate, and all of these things. And that is kind of what this is all about. And then, of course, the whole path kind of falls into place when these things become habits of the mind, and they become natural for you to do all the right things in this way. But it takes perseverance. But it's incredibly worthwhile, because these are the things that we have been just waiting, right? You have been waiting for this opportunity for so long. Now the opportunity is there. Finally, you are in the presence of teachings that teach you these kind of things. Now the opportunity is there, so don't waste it. And then we can make these drastic changes that will have long-term consequences for us for a long time into the future if we make these changes now. This is essentially what this is saying here. So, that is what it is about. So we, of course, much of the point here is that you abandon here, you can see here what you do, you abandon the bad thoughts by thinking the good thoughts. This is the first step on this path towards peace. First of all, we move from bad thinking to good thinking. And this is an important point, because sometimes people think that, you know, you can go straight from kind of having a mind which is full of defilements straight to samadhi, and that's impossible. You can't do that. You have to practice these things gradually. This is one of the reasons why this is called the gradual training, because you abandon things in a graduated way, one step at a time. And first of all, we have to deal with the negative aspects of our personality. Once you have dealt with them, and then you kind of build up the good aspects, then you can kind of move on to samadhi, mindfulness, and then samadhi as a consequence of that. You have to do it in the right sequence, otherwise it's not going to work. Otherwise it just becomes suppression. It becomes something which can kind of blow up again at any time, and it doesn't really work. It just becomes painful and problematic, the whole process. And this, I think, is a very important point to understand, this graduatedness of the training. There is a nice sutta that I've read out in the past about this, which is the sutta on the earth remover, I think it's called. And it's basically about how to refine gold. And it tells you that gold has to be refined in a certain process, starting off by taking out the coarser defilements out of the gold, middling defilements, the refined defilements, and eventually the really fine defilements. And if you don't follow the right sequence, it's not going to work. Yeah, so you start off by just getting your basic sila into shape, then you deal with your thinking mind, then you deal with the refined aspects of the thinking mind, the last kind of defilements, yeah? And then eventually you attain samadhi as a consequence of all of that. So there is a sequence, there is like an art to this, a science almost, if you like, to getting these things right. So that is this idea then again of making these things a habit. This is where we're trying to go. And then once you make them into the habit, then what happens next is the following. So now we move on to the next paragraph, the two paragraphs down. As I abided thus, heedful, energetic, and with effort, a thought of renunciation, in other words, of non-desire, arose in me. I understood thus. This thought of renunciation has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction, to others' affliction, or to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom, does not cause difficulties, and leads to extinguishment. If I think and ponder upon this thought for even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and day, I see nothing to fear from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire the body. And when my body is tired, the mind becomes strained. And when the mind is strained, it is far from stillness. So here, then, we have come to the point where the mind has been purified of those negative thoughts, at least for the most part. And there is no problem, really, with these thoughts. They don't have those bad consequences as the negative ones. And yet, you have to go beyond even the good thoughts. That is what he's saying here. If you don't go beyond thinking, thinking itself is a tiring thing that tires you out, tires the body and also tires the mind at the same time. So because it tires you, it means you can't really rest properly. You can't really fully relax. And this is why you want to steady the mind and you want to bring it to samadhi and stillness so you can get that full rest of the mind, making it very powerful. And this is the idea of samadhi, to make the mind very powerful, very strong, to withstand kind of, so withstand the difficulties that are involved with insight and all of these kind of things. You get a very, very strong mind when you practice in this way. So this is the idea here, is to strengthen the mind in this way. Otherwise, you cannot really have those insights that you want to head towards. And that becomes the problem here. So you steady your mind internally. You quiet it, bring it to singleness, and still it. Why is that? So that my mind should not be strained. And this little sequence, the little last phrase you see here, this is one of the standard phrases you see in the suttas that refer to jhanas. So here we're talking about entering the jhanas, the real samadhi on the Buddhist path. And this whole process here of steadying the mind internally, quietening it and bringing it to singleness, that is really something like watching the breath, right? Anapanasati does that. So this is really what that is. And then as a consequence of that anapanasati, if you practice it in the right way, you achieve samadhi. So here you can see the whole path, in a sense, in progress. You see the right effort, how to deal with the thinking mind. And then when you have dealt with the bad kind of thoughts, then you move on to the anapanasati, watching the breath, which is the seventh factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. And then that watching the breath, then, if it works properly, gives rise to the samadhi, the jhanas. You see the progress here. And here it is very practically how it is laid out. It's very easy to understand what you are supposed to do here. It's kind of fairly straightforward. And this is one of the nice things about this. One of the slightly strange things, again, I just wanted to point out again, is this translation here, what does it say again? A thought of renunciation, or a thought of ill will, or a thought of sensual pleasure. It's rather, I would say, that these thoughts are imbued with these things. This is an underlying motivation for the thought, or an underlying quality of the thought, rather than the thought of ill will, which to me is a little bit strange. In the same way, the thought of metta, right? The thought imbued with metta, the thought imbued with compassion. And this is the words that you see elsewhere in the suttas, that these are the kind of the motivating and the coloring of those thoughts. They're colored by these emotions, if you like. Okay, so that is how that works, roughly. Let's move on to the next paragraph. So the same thing again, with ill will and with harming. So as I abided thus, heedful, energetic, and with effort, a thought of non-ill will, right? A thought of loving kindness, perhaps, a thought of goodwill, a thought of friendliness arose in me, a thought of non-harming arose in me, not ruthless, being ruthful arose in me. The word ruthful actually existed apparently back in the 17th century, the opposite of ruthless. So ruthful, full of ruth. Ruth is compassion, right? So ruthful is full of compassion. So I understood thus, this thought of ruthfulness has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction, to others' affliction, or to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom, does not cause difficulties, and it leads to nibbana. It leads to vipassana, all of these things. If I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and day, I see nothing to fear from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. And when the body is tired, the mind becomes strained. And when the mind is strained, it is far from stillness. So I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, brought it to singleness, and stilled it. Why is that? So that my mind should not be strained. So, there you are, same thing again, very quite repetitive, but same idea being explained. Now we get the simile again, one paragraph down. Just as in the last month of the hot season, when all the crops had been brought inside the villages, a cowherd would guard his cows while staying at the root of a tree or out in the open, since he needs only to be mindful that the cows are there. So too, there was need for me only to be mindful that those qualities, those dhammas is the Pali word here, were present, that they were there. So now you can relax much more, right? The good qualities have been established inside of you. All you can just sit back and have a bit of mindfulness to make sure that the qualities are present, but there's nothing you have to do because the qualities are okay here. And then when you sit back and then you do your meditation practice, it just happens because the mind is ready for the meditation and everything kind of happens as a consequence. So you don't have to push the mind around, don't have to push that cow of a mind in any direction, just let that cow kind of just do, keep on grazing in the right place, and then there's no problems at all. And then we have the same passage again about frequently thinking and pondering, because bhikkhunis, lay men and lay women, whatever someone frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of their mind. If they frequently think and ponder upon thoughts of renunciation, they have abandoned the thought of sensual desire to cultivate the thought of renunciation. And then their mind inclines to thoughts of renunciation. If they frequently think and ponder upon thoughts of non-ill will, metta, goodwill, upon thoughts of harmlessness, they have abandoned the thought of harmfulness to cultivate the thought of harmlessness. And then the mind inclines to such thoughts. So that is where we are trying to get. And when all of these things happen, then the reason, by the way, that I'm swapping these paragraphs around is because, as always, I always like to look at the parallel versions of the suttas in different languages. And the Chinese version of the sutta, the simile comes before that other paragraph. And it kind of fits quite well with the sequence. Right? Maybe that was the original sequence of these paragraphs. That's why I swapped them around like that. Just to keep you informed of what I'm doing when you see me doing weird stuff. I'll just have you be clear about what's going on. Okay, then we have the very last paragraph. Actually, it goes on quite a bit longer, the sutta. It goes on because the Buddha then talks about how he took this all the way to his awakening, right? When he became the Buddha. But this is the last part because it's a bit too early still to go all the way to the end. But then we have this last one. Tireless energy was aroused in me and unremitting mindfulness was established. My body was tranquil and untroubled, my mind stilled and unified. And this is what happens when you abandon those negative states of mind. The mind becomes pure, then that tireless energy arises. It's a nice word, isn't it? The tireless energy, the energy which is always there, the energy which is strong, which you can apply, and it doesn't really, well, eventually it will tire, of course, but there's a feeling of it being tireless as you come to this particular state, and you just keep on applying yourself. And if you keep on practicing samadhi like that, it will be tireless, because it will always be available to you. Of course, once you start interacting with people, you start getting tired again soon enough. That's the nature of interaction with people. But or even if you practice inside and try to kind of see into the nature of reality, that also can be quite tiring in the sense that it can shock you and then kind of takes you out of that stage. And not only is the energy tiring, this is what I was getting at before is that idea when you have energy, mindfulness is also very strong, because that energy is a happy state of mind. There's pamoja there, there's a sense of gladness, the energy is strong, you feel energized. Mindfulness is powerful because the present moment has become the pleasant moment. The mindfulness is unremitting. It means that it doesn't slacken, right? There's no slackening in mindfulness. It is always strong, unremitting mindfulness. And then the body is tranquil and untroubled. And this is one of those nice things about meditation practice. When the meditation goes well, the body relaxes. The body is at ease. And many of those troubles you may have had in the body before, even if you have if you have troubles that are kind of more or less permanent, permanently there, still those often can disappear after a good meditation session. You come out and your body is really at ease. And it doesn't matter how long you sit. This is the weird thing. You can sit there for 10 hours in one posture. Usually if you try to sit for 20 minutes in one posture without moving, you already feel a few aches and pains here and there. But if your meditation is really deep, you sit in for 10 hours without moving a single hair on your body, right? Completely still. And you come out and you feel more at ease than you've ever felt in your entire life. The body is so relaxed, so at ease. There's no problems there. This is one of the great ways of getting out of chronic pains and chronic problems, is to actually get into those meditations. The body becomes untroubled. And the mind is stilled and unified. The mind is one-pointed. The mind is not distracted. It's malleable, wieldy, workable, ready to do the work of insight and discovering the truths of reality. That is what is going on there. Okay, so that is this wonderful sutta about the two kinds of thoughts, Dvaita Vitakka Sutta. And now I will move on to a little bit more on this subject, more about how to remove the negative thinking of the mind, the Vitakka Santana Sutta. This is the sutta which comes after the previous one. Majjhima Nikaya number 20. So this is more on the same topic. So, thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Savati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir," they replied, and the Blessed One said this, "Bhikkhus, when a lay follower is pursuing the higher mind, from time to time they should give attention to five things, five objects, five signs, five marks, five nimittas is the Pali word. What are the five?" So here we are talking about someone who is pursuing the higher mind. The higher mind is the adi-citta in Pali. And the adi-citta basically means samadhi. It's the mind that enters samadhi, the jhanas, and these kind of things. That is what the meaning of the word higher mind here. So this is how you get to that higher mind, right? So this is all about how to get really to the end of the Noble Eightfold Path itself. And it really revolves around this idea of purifying the mind from defilements. And then based on that, you enter into samadhi. So very similar to the previous one, except here the techniques given are a little bit more expanded than in the previous one. So what are these five things, that five ways of attending, if you like, that we should use in this particular case? Here, bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu is giving attention to some sign, a certain, you know, an object, if you like. Object is perhaps the easiest way of translating it here. And owing to that object, there arise in him bad, unwholesome, unskillful thoughts, connected with desire, connected with hate, connected with delusion. Then he should give attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome. When he is giving attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, then any bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with ill will, or with confusion are abandoned in him, and they subside. Yeah, so What we are seeing here is simply a very ordinary thing in life. Sometimes you see something, it gives rise to desire in you. Sometimes you see something else and you get upset about it. Yeah, it is, depends on what the stuff that comes through our senses is is what usually tends to be the triggers to trigger these defilements in our mind. And first of all, we should translate these defilements in a better way. Desire is fine. Hate really should be ill will. Hate is a very strong emotion, and ill will is much more appropriate in this case. Delusion, I would say confusion is better here, because delusion we usually reserve for the root problems, the root distortions of the mind, not seeing non-self and that kind of thing. This is how I would translate these words, to make them more meaningful and immediately accessible to us. So when we kind of go about our things in ordinary life, things come, we see things, we hear things, whatever it is, and these qualities arise as a consequence, yeah? Or not just in your ordinary life, you sit in your meditation practice and suddenly some memory comes up or something from the past, and wham, there you are, kind of defilements coming with it straight away. I'm sure you all know exactly what I'm talking about. It's kind of very what happens to everybody pretty much, except if you are really, really, really advanced on this path. So because of that, so you have to deal with it, whether it is in meditation or in ordinary life, you have to find a way of dealing with these things. And this is then the first way of dealing with this. And that is that you just shift your attention. You shift it to something else, to another sign that is connected with what is wholesome. So what is this other sign? And that other sign could be anything. It could be another object altogether. So if you are kind of some person is giving you is causing difficulties for you, you start talking to somebody else, right, or something like that, or you give attention to somebody else, or you are thinking about a certain person and you think about somebody else instead. This is one way of doing that. But one other way, which is probably more profound and more useful, is not to shift the object, stay with the object, but look at the object in a different way. Because we have to learn, especially when it comes to people, we need to learn how to deal with people in such a way whereby that ill will, desire, etc. does not arise in our minds. So you see the good quality in that person. You forgive them for the negative qualities. You understand, you have compassion for the problems that may be there. And then, of course, you abandon that whole thing while you are kind of staying with the same object, just looking at the object in a different way. And this is more powerful because it means that in the future, when you come back to this object in the future, that tendency to ill will, to desire, whatever it is, will be lessened and there will be less of a problem there. If you just look away, it's not going to have the same power to resolve things in the future. So that is really all there is to it, right? It's fairly straightforward. But of course, as I was saying this morning, the only way that this actually works, the only way you can shift your attention and look in a different place, in a different way, it is only going to work if you have tried a little bit in the past. You know what you're doing. You know what it means to shift your attention. You have thought about the good qualities of the other person, right? You haven't kind of just dismissed it. Yeah, no, they are just, you're so upset with them. You only want to see the bad qualities. You don't want to see the good stuff in them. This is what it's like. We judge people according to how we feel about them. So you have actually put in a bit of effort into that. And then you have the ability to bring back that memory, that perception from the self. You bring it down. And then you impose that onto that object. And then the thing disappears. So as it always takes a little bit of training, a little bit of work with our perceptions. And this is really where this comes in. And then, of course, bang, the bad state just vanishes into thin air, into thin mind, into the empty mind. Thin air and empty mind, maybe that's kind of similar. It vanishes in the empty mind, and all you have left with is the positive thing instead. And that is what this is all about. And then, what comes next then is that with the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness and stilled. So while you're sitting in a meditation, first of all, as you start out, you have some bad thoughts that are not very useful. Then you abandon them using some of these techniques. And as these thoughts are abandoned, then it's almost as if that samadhi starts to happen by itself. The breath becomes clear and you kind of just move forward easily because the hindrances are gone. Just as a skilled carpenter or his apprentice might knock out, remove, or extract a coarse peg by means of a fine one, so too when a bhikkhu gives attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, etc., his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and stilled. The coarse peg, of course, being the bad thoughts, the fine peg being the good thoughts. And of course, the fine peg, you have to get rid of that one as well, but that's kind of easy. It's the coarse peg that is hard to get rid of. And then when that fine peg is there, all you have to do is to watch your breath a little bit, and then things start to become very beautiful and peaceful when you do that. So this is method one. This method is often called substitution. You just substitute one way of looking at the object with another way. And as always, it's very important to catch ourselves early. This is why mindfulness is so important, right? The more clear your awareness is, the more power that mindfulness has, the more ability you have to catch it, nip it in the bud, as I say, straight away, as it is about to blossom out, you get it straight away. Once a thought is strongly established in the mind, it's very hard to get rid of. Yeah, if you really, once you kind of get really upset with somebody for whatever reason, it's very difficult to get rid of that thought afterwards. Or you get a strong desire for something, very hard to get rid of once it is established. So it's so important to get these things early, and this is where mindfulness comes in. You see where your mind is heading, going down the wrong eightfold path, right? Heading towards mitsa this and mitsa that, and eventually things going in the wrong direction towards more suffering instead. Okay, method one. Method number two, very similar to what we have just seen before, the previous sutta. If while he is giving attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, there still arise in him bad, unwholesome thoughts, connected with desire, connected with ill will, and connected with confusion, then he should examine the danger in those thoughts thus. These thoughts are unwholesome. They are akusala. They are reprehensible. They are savajja. They are blameworthy, quite literally. They result in suffering. Dukkha vipaka, right? Vipaka, kama vipaka, dukkha vipaka is the Pali word here. When he examines the danger in those thoughts, then any bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with ill will, and with confusion, they are abandoned in him and they subside. So this is very similar to what we saw in the previous sutta, that was all about knowing the danger and the suffering that arises from certain thoughts. And this is exactly what you're doing here. If something is akusala, akusala means like unskillful. If something is unskillful, it is a little bit like ayoniso manasikara. You're thinking in the wrong way, and because of that, more suffering and problems arise as a consequence. They are reprehensible, it says here. Savajja, blameworthy. They are with fault. They have a fault to them. They are faulty, if you like. And they result in suffering. So we already saw that in the previous sutta. So this is a very similar kind of thing. Remember that when we are looking at these five things here, there is a certain hierarchy. Everything in Buddhism is hierarchical. Every sequence has a reason. Everything is savyanjanang. Everything is well proclaimed, right? With the right phrasing in the sutta. So there is a purpose to everything. Nothing is really random. So it means that the first method here is really the most powerful one. So it means very often that you have already understood the danger in these things. You have the alternative perception just waiting to be used whenever the bad perception arises, and you apply that straight away. You use this idea of substitution. But sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes you have to first of all, learn how to see the danger in these things. You have to reflect on that. The first method isn't strong enough. And then you sit down and you reflect on it more purposefully. And this is what is happening here in the second method. So the second method is what you apply if the first one doesn't work. Then you apply the second one. It's hierarchical. The first one is the most powerful one. Bang! It's just gone. And your mind is wholesome, right? And then the second one is where you have to kind of apply yourself a bit more, you know, thinking about this carefully with the yoniso manasikara to get to the right spot. So, one after the other. So, and then this is true for the remaining three as well. They come afterward. They are kind of further down the scale, if you like. So then you abandon them according to what we saw in the previous sutta. And when you do abandon them, the mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and stilled. Just as a man or a woman, actually it should be just as a woman or a man. In this case, the iti, the woman, comes first, and purisa comes afterwards. So young, youthful, fond of ornaments, would be horrified, humiliated, and disgusted if the carcass of a snake or a dog or a human being were hung around her or his neck. Yeah, oh, it's really, really powerful stuff. So how would you feel if a carcass of a dog was or a snake was hung around your neck? Would you say, oh yeah, no worries, that's fine? Or would you kind of sort of get rid of it pretty fast? You would be pretty disgusted, right? Especially if it's kind of an old carcass and full of all kind of... Sometimes, as a monk, one of the great things about being a monk and being so close to nature is that you see animals dying in the forest all the time. You see the kangaroos dying, right? And you see them, how they rot. And it's not very nice to see this. In the beginning, they look really intact. But after only a couple of days, it just starts stinking and crawling with maggots and all of this kind of thing. It's really a very disgusting sight. And you get this, you know, you get this, this is what you see basically, what it's like when something dies like this. And the body becomes extremely repulsive at that particular stage. It is, in a sense, good to see, right? This is the nature of the body. This is what it's like. And then eventually, there's nothing left eventually, just bones remaining. It doesn't take long, a few days, and that kangaroo is just reduced to bones pretty much. A little bit of skin perhaps, but that's about it. So anyway, that's a bit of a sidetrack here. So this is what you do. You remember that you should try see these bad thoughts as that, right? As a carcass of a dog. It's fascinating because, it's so hard to see those thoughts like that. When you get angry with somebody, you feel that you are... in your right to get angry. They have done something bad. Of course you have to get angry, right? They are stupid. You need to tell them off. Somebody got to sort them out. If nobody else is going to do it, you're going to do it. Or something like that. Or desires. Oh, it's just happiness and just kind of enjoying myself, you know, and these kind of things. And to actually see these things as a carcass of a dog hanging around your neck, kind of hanging around your mind, if you like. Actually, it is quite difficult. But very... very useful to think like that, because when you think like that, you realize that these things cause you far more suffering than the carcass of a dog. Carcass of a dog is not a big problem. You just go and have a shower afterwards and you're okay again. You can't. But this thing here, this is much more insidious. This stuff kind of is going to leave a stain for lifetimes to come afterwards. Yeah, you're creating bad habits in your mind, and these things come back and bite you and stink also in future lives. And this is the problem with these things. The very powerful idea there, how to look at these kind of thoughts. Almost too powerful. It's almost hard to understand. So that's what happens then. And when you examine that danger, then they become steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and stilled. And if that doesn't work, method number three. If, while he is examining the danger in those thoughts, there still arise in him bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, connected with ill will, and connected with confusion, then he should try to forget those thoughts. He should not give attention to them. when he tries to forget those thoughts and does not give attention to them, then any bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with ill will, and with confusion are abandoned in him and subside. And here the idea, I think, is just that you sit in meditation and a bad thought comes up and you just kind of ignore it and you just stay with the breath. You can see it's there, but no, just, okay, hold, stay on with the breath and you just do that. I think that is kind of the idea here. So you don't pay any attention to it. You can see it coming up, but you kind of ignore it, essentially. Or you just keep on doing whatever else it is that you happen to be doing at the time, and you just ignore that thought in your mind. So then with the abandoning of them, again the same thing. It becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and stilled. Just as a man with good eyes who did not want to see forms. In other words, shapes, right? Certain shapes that had come within range of sight would either shut his eyes or look away. So too, when a bhikkhu tries to forget those thoughts and does not pay attention to them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and stilled as a consequence. So you shut your eyes. This is like forgetting them. Forgetting, this is like not having any mindfulness about them, taking away your mindfulness from those things. It's very similar to not giving attention to them. So you just forget about those things. So this is the third way, right? If the other ways don't work, then this is what you do. You don't pay any attention to that thought. Every one of these is getting weaker. Every one of these methods gets weaker as you move down. And by far the most powerful ones are the first two. These are the ones where we really should put the effort in to act according to the first two methods here. As you go down the list, it becomes weaker and weaker and weaker. But sometimes you don't have much choice. You just have to use those weaker methods. And very often it is like a waiting game. You just have to wait for those thoughts. They have kind of inhabited your mind and taken over your mind like some ghost or something, taken over your mind, and they kind of, you can't get rid of them anymore, so you just have to wait. And this is what this next one is about. This is like this, the waiting thing. You have to wait for these things to disappear. If while he is trying to forget those thoughts and not give attention to them, they still arise in him, bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, connected with ill will, and connected with confusion, then he should give attention to the stilling of the thought formation of those thoughts. Vitakka Santana Santana. And what this means, and this may not be very obvious what that means, the thought formation, what it means is the will power, right? The will which lies behind those thoughts, the volition, the intention, the choice that you make to actually think those thoughts. And this is kind of one of the almost like scary things about these negative thoughts, is that usually we choose to actually think these things. There is a choice. These thoughts don't arise on their own. At some point we have the intention to think these things. Of course, the intentions themselves are often very automatic, they're very heavily conditioned, yet still, at some point there is a choice happening, and that choice is, okay, I'm going to think these negative thoughts. You see some image, some negative perception that you don't like, and then the mind makes that choice to think negative thoughts about it. So because of that, there is a momentum, there's something that drives that thinking mind. That is the intention, that is the volition, the will behind it. It is driven by these things. And of course, because there is a driver behind these thoughts, because there's something that makes them arise, they don't come out of nothing. They're not just like, random things that happen inside of us. Because of that, it's possible to withdraw that will. It's possible to withdraw that intention. And this is what so much of meditation is about. Meditation is about sitting back and waiting. Because when you wait, when you just sit back, when you are passive, when you are like the passenger on the train, just looking out of the window, just seeing the landscape passing by, that landscape being like the breath, right? When you do that, there is no intention there. There is no will. There is no effort. There is no there's nothing that drives you anymore. And because of that, things tend to calm down. Because all of this thinking, all the stuff, is driven by our intention. It's by being passive. You're not driving it anymore. Yeah? And this is what is happening here. So you're understanding back, trying to be aware, trying to be mindful, and then things calm down all by themselves. This is the idea here. This is the idea that lies behind so much of meditation practice as well. The ability to be passive, the ability to be aware. So all of these things, they need to be fed all the time to sustain themselves. And by not feeding them, by being passive, they pass away. So, the thought formation, literally here, is the will behind the thought. That's what it means. So you still the will, you still the volition, you still the intention behind the thinking mind. That's the meaning of that. When he gives attention to the stilling of that thought volition of those thoughts, then any bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, connected with ill will, and connected with delusion, they are abandoned in him, and they subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and stilled. Then we have the simile. Just as a man walking fast might consider, why am I walking fast? What if I walk slowly? Yeah, so this is like the mind. The mind is running all over the place. Why am I thinking so fast? Maybe I can think a bit more slowly. And he would walk slowly, and then he might consider, why am I even walking slowly? What if I stand? And he would stand. Then he might consider, why am I standing? What if I sit? And he would sit. And then he might consider, why am I sitting? What if I lie down? And he would lie down. By doing so, he would substitute for each grosser posture one that was subtler. You can see what is going on here. And what is going on is that when you withdraw and you are just the passive observer, the nature of the mind is to slow down because you're no longer feeding it. And this is how you sometimes can get rid of even the most persistent thinking in the mind, the persistent negative thinking that sometimes obsesses even the best of people. You get rid of it by just standing back, allowing it to die away. Eventually, the momentum and the power of that thought will just die away on its own. And that is what you are doing here. But this can sometimes take a while, especially if you are busy and many things happening. It can take a while for things to kind of die down on their own like this. This is the idea here. This is the fourth method, so coming fairly down on the list. And now, then again, he gives attention to this, and then his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and stilled. And now we come to the last method. Remember, this is the last method. And this is where finally willpower is finally allowed a little bit of a room to kind of deal with things if it becomes too obsessive and too difficult. So if, while he is giving attention to the stilling of the thought volition, the volition in the thought, the will in the thought, of those thoughts, there still arise in him bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, connected with ill will, connected with confusion. Then, with his teeth cleansed and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he should beat down, constrain, and crush mind with mind. When, with his teeth cleansed, his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he beats down, constrains, and crushes mind with mind, then any bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with ill will, and with confusion are abandoned in him and subside. So this is the sort of thing you do if you have some really tendencies inside of you which are really bad, in particular, right? If you want to go and kill somebody or something like that, then you have to use this method to stop yourself. Otherwise, you're going to make a lot of bad karma. So that is where that comes in. But the problem is, and this is a very big problem in meditation and anyone who is very sincere on the spiritual path, we tend to go to this last method first. Right? You know what I mean? You kind of, you go around your daily life and some unpleasant thought, and you think, oh, I don't want to think that. And you kind of push it aside using willpower instead of using these other methods, which are much better, of looking at the good qualities, thinking of the dangers. Instead, we tend to go straight to this one and use that force, the willpower in the mind. But it should be the last resort when we're absolutely desperate and we are afraid of being reborn in a bad destination because of some of these bad thoughts. That is when we use this one. Huh? And it is quite dangerous because sometimes people overuse the willpower. It leads to repression. It leads to all kinds of problems. So we have to be very careful with these kind of methods. So please remember that. It is the last resort. It is definitely not the first resort. And very often we have to learn to undo some of our bad habits of using this kind of thing as a first resort rather than as a last resort. And then you are doing it here according to how the Buddha talks about this. Okay. Then he says that if he does that, then what happens? Then his mind again becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness and stilled. Just as a strong man might seize a weaker man by the head and shoulders and beat him down, constrain him and crush him. So too, with his teeth cleansed and tongue pressed against the roof of the mouth, a bhikkhu beats down, constrains and crushes mind with mind. And then your mind becomes steadied internally. Well, hopefully. Quieted, brought to singleness and concentrated. So quite a violent image there, in fact, from the suttas. So, and then the sutta ends off. Actually, it goes a little bit further. It ends off by saying that if you practice in this way, you become master of the pathways, the master of the ways of your thinking mind. And whatever thought you want to think, that is what you think. And whatever thought you don't want to think, you don't think that. And you become become in charge of your own mind. And what a wonderful thing that is, to be in charge of your own mind, right? Often we feel as if the mind is in charge of us, and it's not really the case. It's just that bad habits from the past keep on coming back to us. And one day, your mindfulness is so strong, your ability to deal with these things are so powerful, that you feel in charge of your mind instead. What a delightful idea of being in charge of one's mind, rather than always being under the thumb of one's past habits and bad personality traits. So, there you are, the five ways of dealing with unwholesome thoughts. And again, remember there is a sequence here. So start, use the first two ones as much as you possibly can. And the last ones are more like sense when things don't really work out, that's when you use these last ones. So that is all for now. Tomorrow I'm going to look at one of my other favorite suttas from the Pali Canon. I never get tired of reading these suttas, even though I read them a lot, because they always remind me of what I have to do. And I need that reminder. I think we all need that reminder. And so every time I read them, I try to read them with a fresh eye and with a fresh kind of view to take on board perhaps even more of the information that is in. There's always more to be learned from these beautiful similes and beautiful ways of dealing with things. But anyway, that will be coming tomorrow morning. So in the meantime, keep on enjoying yourself, and we'll see you again at 7:30 tonight.